night. This is Jill Ajeezy, and welcome to Family Matters. Judge Michelle is on her way, got a little tied up in court, and she called me and said, I may be just a few minutes late. We have an exciting show for you tonight. Our guest, Suzanne Vinker, is here, and just some exciting stuff to talk about. But before we get into the show, I have Danica Joan Fields on the line. How are you, Danica?
I'm good. Can you hear me?
Can hear you wonderfully, and I am so excited that I get to see you in just 2 days, and we are planning something exciting. Do you want to tell everybody about it?
Well, we've been planning here in Florida, like the first family advocacy conference that Florida has had. It's a parental alienation education conference and workshop. It's 2 days. On Friday, it's for professionals. It's for mental health professionals and legal professionals and educators and they can earn continuing ed credits by attending this conference, and our goal to educate these professionals who are impacted by high conflict families. And then the second day is a workshop. It's a workshop for advocates. It's people like you and me who really want to take up this cause and start getting the word out. So we have a leader there who is an expert at bringing teams together and so that they can impact their community.
And how can people participate in that advocacy day if they're not close to Lakeland, Florida, Danica?
Well, it's all going to be recorded, but the second day it's going to be streamed live on the web on an iCast. So all you have to do is go to kidsneedboth.org and just log in. So there's live streaming, and there's going to be chat, and we will have a moderator that will facilitate any questions that somebody on the web would like to ask the leader.
And I'm Friday, the all-day conference on Friday, we have Dr. Mike Bone, Dr. Bob Evans, and of course, Attorney Brian Ludmer from Canada is coming in, and it is just, I mean, you can't ask for better people in the field of parental alienation. If we had Amy Baker, we would have a trifecta. You know, it would be a great day. So if you are in the Lakeland area, Tampa or Orlando, and you can get to Lakeland to participate in this conference, and you deal with anything having to do with parental alienation, I would just encourage you to come, because the information that's going to be disseminated on Friday is priceless. And the cost, Danica, what's the cost on that?
The cost, if you are seeking continuing ed credits, you would be considered a professional. And we have two rates. We have half a day for $40 and full day for $80. And I was informed by several professionals that's a very, very affordable price for a continuing ed kind of workshop.
It is.
The public is half of that. It's $20 for each session or $40 for the whole day.
So if you're a parent and you're going through this and you need some information, please feel free to come. And of course, the advocacy is so important, because at Parental Alienation Awareness Organization USA, which I am the president, and Danica, you are the chapter leader in Florida, we are all about education and awareness and getting the word out about parental alienation and how to deal with it and what it is. And if you're just coming into this whole arena, how to deal with it and what steps you should take. So advocacy is incredibly important in this area. We've got to get the word out to let people know you can't use your children as a weapon and a battlefield in adversarial divorce. So, Danica, I am excited to see you on Friday and Saturday, and I appreciate everything you've done. Of course, you're co-sponsoring this with Parental Alienation Awareness Organization USA with your group, kidsneedboth.org. And so everybody, if you're interested, go to Danica's website and take a look. And if you want to come, you're more than welcome. So, Danica, I will see you. Anything else we need to talk about?
I don't think so. I'm looking forward to it. It is going to be such an awesome, positive weekend. And that's really what I'm all about, is to putting together people who are positive and they're willing to make a difference and change the conversation in a resigned community.
You're right. You're absolutely right. So keep that positive attitude, and we'll see you on Friday.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Danica. Bye-bye. Okay, let's get into our show. We will hope Michelle is in the cab on the way to the studio so she can join us. I want to get right into this with Suzanne, though. I don't want to leave 1 minute without conversation with Suzanne. So Suzanne has written 3 books. The first book was about motherhood. The second book, and it also encompassed the needs of children. The second takes a provocative look at feminism's influence on America. And the third is about marriage and the modern generation. Suzanne, I'm seeing a theme. can you talk about that theme? And
yeah.
What's going on with you and why are you writing these books?
Oh, I know. Crazy. I have to tell you, there was no grand plan, believe me, for 3 books whatsoever. One thing sort of led to another, but there's clearly no question that my heart and my passion and my interests lie just squarely in the family, you know, marriage and the family and all that that encompasses, which is a lot. So clearly enough for 3 books. And then also just the politics of the whole thing, which is why the last book was focused on feminism, because that subject has really been a definite interest of mine for as long as I can remember. And I've always known and felt that it was destructive, and that led to that second book. Now, this last one is really, though, where my the one I'm most excited about, let's put it that way. Not because I've just written it and it's fresh, but because it's so universal. You know, it crosses really the spectrum in terms of race, class, age, you know, gender. It's just it's an issue. I mean, marriage, love and marriage. You know, who doesn't bump up against that in your life?
Right.
You know?
Right.
So from that angle, it's just so different from the first 2. So I'm excited.
Well, so you were a teacher. You turned author and social critic. So tell me of what led you to where you are now. Let's talk about that. You went to school, Boston University, right?
Right, right.
You're in St. Louis.
Right, yeah.
You have a husband and 2 children.
Mm-hmm.
And so tell me, when you were a teacher, what led you to start writing these books?
To get here, yeah. So I had about 10 years that I lived up east, up in New York and Boston. And that was I feel like I've lived 2 lives, to be honest.
Did you?
So that, honestly, I mean, I lived in a different state and I had a different job. And now I'm here doing something completely different. I've been here for 15 years. And I was married before, which we'll get into, because obviously it's
important.
Significant to the book. So I lived up east, and that whole experience teaching was pretty shocking. I was really blown away by the things I saw in public schools today. So I quit. I quit several jobs, actually. I kind of went to it from job to job because each school was the same. I think I was looking for some you know, I wasn't even looking for utopia. I was just looking for something that worked, and I couldn't find it. And so I got pretty fed up by the 4th year and just quit. And started to write a book about what's going on inside America's classrooms. And then what happened there was that my first marriage sort of went south at that point, and that book never got completed. And then I moved home to St. Louis, and one thing led to another. And by the time I met my second husband and was pregnant with my first child, then I picked up the pen again. And at that point, of course, it took it on a different subject matter. Because motherhood was my focus then. So that's how the first actual book got published, and that's, 12 years ago now. My daughter's 12, my son's 9, and then didn't pick up again, you know, until just last year, or 2002. Was that last year? Wait, where am I?
Yeah, this is 2012.
Oh, right. Okay.
I'm pretty sure.
I'll refresh that. 2011, my... Flip Side of Feminism was published. So there's a huge gap in there because I was knee deep in child care at that point. So and then now this next one. So that's how it happened.
Well, there's an interesting point that we just talked about, and I knew this. Your publicist actually told me that Phyllis Schlafly is your aunt, right?
She is. Mm-hmm, my mom's sister.
How did Phyllis influence
you
in all of this feminism?
So I think what separated me from my contemporaries with this subject, because as you know, feminism has just sort of been a very politically correct topic. Everybody's sort of on the same page about it, presumably because it's supposedly this good thing. And I had this advantage, if you will, in that Phyllis was my aunt, so I was exposed to an alternative view to that very politically correct subject from a very young age. And so between her sort of activism, if you will, and then my mother's views, which matched matched Phyllis's, mm-hmm. I just was raised with a very different take on the whole issue of women and men and women's role in society and the whole having it all thing and what women and men can do and how they're different and how they're the same, all that stuff. My take on it was just very different from all of my contemporaries. So I knew that early on. When I was in school, I would be talking about this, and they sort of looked at me like I had 10 heads.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So anybody hearing me, like if somebody picked up and heard this right now from college days, they wouldn't be in the least bit surprised because I've been talking about this for a long time. So I would say my her effect on my life was just simply that, just a different viewpoint than the one mm-hmm. you get in the media and from college professors. And so that definitely had to have had an effect on my views on the matter, obviously.
How do you think some of those people that you had contact with that looked at you like you had horns or 10 heads, how do you think they are thinking about life now? Have they taken toward your viewpoint, or do you not keep in contact? Do you not know?
You know what? I think about that all the time. And I have no clue because I do not have any contact with them.
It would be interesting
only because
to know, though.
It is, and it's only because I'm from the Midwest. I went to school in Boston, and just about all of my friends were, of course, from the tri-state area there.
Yeah.
So I was out from the middle of nowhere, basically. And so it was hard to keep up kind of thing. But, yeah, I do wonder that. I absolutely wonder, and I just don't know.
It would be an interesting study to do just to see if some of those women and there's an interesting point. Do you think people being from the East – have a different viewpoint about working mothers and being a mother and or people from the West or people from the Midwest? How do you see the different geographic regions thinking about this issue?
That is a great question, especially considering the fact that I've lived in both of those areas. So, I would say it's absolutely different in that up east it is such a given that this way of life with the dual income family, daycare, all of that stuff, it's not even up for debate. You almost can't even have a conversation about it because it's just so obvious which way you're supposed to think about that. Now, that might be in part, and I've given credit to this in my last book, that, there's definitely a difference between New York and California and the cost of living versus the rest of the country. I, in fact, actually left the New York area partly for that reason, and we can get into that. But the point being that they definitely have a different take on it, and the middle of the country is much more family-centered and much more grounded in terms of their values. And the East and the West Coasts are just so caught up in all that hype and all that, in the media and the stuff. And it's just such a different way of life. It really, really is. That had everything to do with what happened with my first marriage. So it's definitely different. On the other hand, because I've written 3 books and I've heard from so many different people from different areas of the country, I'm always surprised to find people, for example, in Manhattan who contact me and who are completely on the same page, and then people from, Nebraska who mm-hmm. aren't. So you'd be surprised. But, I think it's a fair generalization that, the East and West Coast are different from the middle of the country.
Yeah, yeah. I always have said, as long as I can remember, that I think motherhood is the hardest job that there is. And I look at my own mother. As I turn 51 next month, and I think about everything that she did, and I always wanted to say to her, is this what you really wanted? Would you rather have been a stewardess when when you went to Eastern Airlines and they told you you were too skinny, go home? So, you know, would you rather have done that? Or were you happy being the wonderful mother that you were? Because I see women, mothers from my friends' mothers who were the backbones of their families and who worked very, very hard to make sure that everybody had a wonderful meal three times a day, and everybody sat at the table together. And as I sat on a committee here in Illinois called the Illinois Family Law Study Committee to rewrite the Illinois Marriage and Dissolution Act, and we bantered around for hours about what is the family today. There were so many different definitions that came up, and some of them didn't even involve having a mother.
So telling.
How important is motherhood in today's society as we look at the new definition of the nuclear family?
Right. So that's a great question. Of course, I've written extensively about that. My new book, How to Choose a Husband, isn't about that topic per se, although there is an entire chapter on that issue.
Yes.
And so just to sum up in terms of what I've said there is that I've often pointed out that women's progress outside the home in the last 40 years or whatever has meant regress for women inside the home. And by that, I mean, I'm just referring to the whole having it all argument, if you will, or debate that won't go away. And my point is that by directing our attention outward, outside the home, instead of inward over this last 30 or 40 years, we've come up against something that we can't seem to rectify. And that is that, wow, raising children really took work. You know, it is an actual taxing, full-time commitment. And, yeah, you don't get paid for it, but the reality is it's, like you said, harder than anything else you'll do. And the only people who know that are the people who actually do it. And once you do, it's pretty shocking. I mean, there are people who sort of go with the cultural trend of thinking planning their whole life around their career and then making the decisions accordingly, and then the baby arrives, or baby number two, or God forbid, baby number three, and you say, whoa, this isn't going to work. Something's got to give. So that's where I come in, where I'm trying to get people to think differently than the culture is telling them to think so that they can plan properly for whatever it is they really want.
So hi, everybody. It's Michelle. I'm sorry. I was tied up in court.
Hi.
And hi, Susan. It's nice to meet you. I come on with a question, which would be, what are the top three things of ways to be thinking differently?
Oh, wow. You can just jump in there and get the idea.
Isn't that?
How did you do that so quickly?
I started wings.
She was a dancer.
That is great. Okay, so the answer would be, number one, choose a career that is flexible and works well with motherhood. And by that I mean, and by the way, this isn't anything different than women have been doing forever. We just don't hear a lot about it. So when you hear people talk about how women have traditionally always gone into those teacher jobs and nursing and whatnot, it has to do with the nurturing factor of being female. But it also has to do with the fact that those jobs are not as time intensive, or at least they can be done on a lighter basis than some of the bigger jobs.
Give us examples of some of these nice flexible jobs.
Ones that you can work from home. That's great.
Like and telemarketing.
No, are you kidding?
Really.
What I do, for example, is write, and that's a huge thing, especially today with, of course, computers and bloggers and all of the internet possibilities. There's people that create websites, for example. I don't know how to do this, but they know how to do this, and they've created a way to make money from home. So there's no question that it's easier to do that today than it has ever been. So that's one thing. The other thing is just jobs that you can go in and out of a little bit more easily, where you might start off and then, you know, take your time out and then go back. Although I will point out that quite often people find that what they started doing prior to opting out, by the time they went back in, they really weren't interested anymore in what they were doing previous. So that's an important point, because it points out that people change. You know, their priorities change, their interests change, their the whole trajectory that they had planned when they were 22 isn't necessarily going to work out the way they anticipated, and that's okay. That's not a bad thing.
So jobs that were interactive, actually, with adults would probably not be too flexible from home.
I don't know. Give me an example. What do you mean?
Well, anything in the workplace where there's other people, you know, like other people.
Well, teachers, teaching, education.
Other people, businesses, lawyers, doctors, Indian chiefs, accountants, marketers, PR, builders, general contract, whatever, where there has to be people wouldn't actually be one of the good jobs to go after.
Well, let's put it this way. If you have an employer where you have to show up somewhere every single day from 8 to 5, that's absolutely going to cause a conflict, no question.
Yeah, no, it is. So you think this is having a bad effect on children?
I do, but you know what? That's not what my new book is about. So I don't want to spend too much time on it because I've already written about that.
We won't. But
yes, I do, and that's it's another conversation we can have. But that's definitely been harmful to the family, no question.
Suzanne, I've got a call I want to grab here. Let's pick this
up.
They have a question for you. Caller from the 217 area code. What's your name?
Hi, Robert Farrar.
Hi, Robert.
Robert.
Question.
Hey.
Hi,
Suzanne. In the little synopsis of tonight's program, it's written modern, and since the modern woman has been taught not to depend on a man financially, she tends to choose for love instead of examining whether or not the man can afford to support her. Feel that's detrimental, or are you still looking at whether, in exactly those terms, that a woman should be looking at a man in terms of whether or not he can support her?
Robert, I'm going to let Suzanne answer that. Thanks for calling.
So I'm so glad you asked that question, Robert, because that is a significant part of my new book, How to Choose a Husband, where I specifically state that one of the cultural messages that has undermined love and been so harmful for the modern generation is this browbeating of mothers who taught their daughters to never depend on a man. And I think that there is simply no question that you have an entire generation of women who were raised with that in mind, and that that has been destructive in that it sets up a negative right off the bat. Right? It basically has you thinking in a negative way about the men that you are dating and potentially going to marry. The idea being that you cannot depend on that person because he is not going to care for you properly, or he's going to hurt you, or he's going to leave you, or what have you. And that there's sort of a psychological process that goes on if you're entering something with that in mind. Now, there's no question that so many of the mothers that sent that message to their daughters were speaking from experience. They were talking about their own story, and I appreciate that. But the reality is, passing that on and not giving your daughter a chance to maybe have a different life than you, and that maybe the guy that she marries is a better guy or is going to have a different story, is not helpful.
Wait, hold on for 1 second. Both parties, man and woman, should depend on each other in many, many ways.
Absolutely.
Using what we mean by depend.
Sure.
But to financially depend on a man, which is, I think, what you're talking about, in a culture that has a 50% divorce rate, what kind of message would that be? God bless the child that's got his own. On some level, that's the message mothers have to give as well. And you're saying the opposite. And I understand why. Because truly, it hasn't fared well for the family.
What hasn't fared well?
The high divorce rate and women's financial independence. I'm the first to agree.
So, when we look
at the statistics, we know the divorce rates are up.
Right, and so what I'm saying is the divorce rate of the last 40 years and compared to our mother's generation or our grandmother's generation or what have you is obviously worse as a result of, partly, this new attitude of not depending on men. And so that is a bad situation to be in. So what I want to encourage women to do is to just reverse that basically and say, assume that the person that you've chosen, assuming that you've chosen well, and my book explains how to choose well, obviously, assuming that you've done that and you've taken those steps, the natural way, if you will, if you plan on having children, and most people do, is to, like you said, depend on each other. And part of that for the male-female and children scenario involves depending on a man's paycheck so that during those years that you want to be at home, it may be 3 years, it may be 5 years, it may be 18 years, and you know, whatever, depending on how many children you have too, is such an important part of the marriage contract. It's such an important part for both partners to be able to understand that each person brings something of value to the table, and that if you allow men to do that, I think they really want to do that, and that that's sort of been taken away from them. That's one thing.
Can we let the women be the one who are the financially stronger person?
You mean like just switch the breadwinner?
Yeah, to have the stay-at-home dad.
Absolutely. I have no issue with that. However, the reality is it's most people won't choose that route. That doesn't mean there's anything wrong with that route, but that most people won't. So that's why I focus so much on it being the male breadwinner and the female, not because there's anything wrong with the reverse, but because that's what most people choose. And there's good reasons for that, and that's okay. That's not a bad thing. That's something to embrace. And if you rely on each other and build each other up from that place of dependence, then your marriage will ultimately be stronger. It's going into it with this attitude that you're going to be screwed if you depend on anybody, when in fact that's what marriage is. It is depending.
But
if you want to be independent forever, don't get married.
But I don't think women have the attitude, I better not depend on this guy because I'm going to get screwed. I think women have the attitude, I've always wanted to be a doctor. I've always wanted to be a pharmacist. That's
okay.
my one of my passions. I don't think that it necessarily anymore comes from a place of paranoia.
Okay, and so that's kind of a little different conversation because I appreciate that point. And if it is coming from that, my response to that would be you might be planning and thinking about this whole life that you want to have that's career-based up until the point when you actually are holding your baby in your arms, and then guess what? Chances are that's going to change dramatically. And so knowing that most people are going to want to care for those babies for however long that may be, in order to be able to make that happen, you're going to have to financially depend on your husband. That's my point. So rather than go in on it, assuming that you're never going to, and then making the decisions that are going to demand that you keep working because you made all these decisions assuming you were never going to depend on a man, is actually counterintuitive to what you're going to ultimately want to do and counterproductive to your goal.
So let's talk about how to choose a husband.
Okay. Well, I basically begin by saying that the sort of the crux of the book is to say that women need to recondition their brains, if you will, to think about marriage in a completely different way, a way that contradicts the way they've been taught since they were young. And by that I mean two things. One is, keep in mind, these are the children of the divorce culture, right? So chances are most people that you run into today, either their parents were divorced or their family members were divorced or their friends or what have you. Divorce is just sort of nothing anymore. It's just the way it is. So if you've been raised with this culture of divorce, your whole outlook on marriage as an institution is going to be, A, not the way it used to be when there wasn't a divorce culture, meaning it's changed the way you look at it, and B, it's negative, obviously. You're fearful. You're sort of absorbing all of this turmoil and wondering how you're going to do things differently, maybe, or is it even possible to have a long marriage or any marriage for any period of time? And so that's a huge burden that the modern generation is dealing with, is having been raised in a divorce culture. That's not a light thing, you know, so that's sort of one piece of it. And that's because they have no role models, either from their own homes or from society, and they're sort of looking for where are the people who have been married 30, 40, 50 years, because honestly, if you find them, even if they are few and far between, talk to them, ask them, how do you do it? What do you suggest? What are your thoughts? Because they can provide information that people, their own mothers may not.
So what information have you found?
The second thing is the cultural messages that are bearing down on them. Not depending on a man is one of them. And then, of course, there's a slew of other things that undermine their ability to be happily married. One of them is this false notion of equality. So they have been, the modern generation has been raised to believe, basically, that equality, being equal with a man, means being, that equality means sameness, if you will. So, for example, my version of equality, I don't know about yours, but I think the average person thinks of equality as just equal value, meaning what you do is worthy of what I do, and same holds true for a man and a woman. But that's not the kind of equality that the modern generation has grown up with. They grow up thinking that means that men and women are virtually the same, that it's sort of an androgynous culture, that you can be interchangeable with men, that because women can do anything that a man can do and vice versa, there really isn't that much difference between them other than their private parts, let's say. So their whole outlook on the opposite sex is almost one of friendship, you know, one of, you know, like just that, just your friend, like you're just on the same plane. There's just not a lot of differences between you, and that is so that is.
I don't know. Ever since John Gray came out with Men Are from Mars, I think that even the most accomplished woman accepts that men are very different than women.
Well, here's an example of what I mean. So when you're growing up and planning your life today, you're thinking of men and women, there's no discussion or room about how women are different from men in terms of bodies, what not only they can do with their bodies in terms of giving birth and being a mother, but also sexually. So sex is a big one, right? That's the biggest example of how the modern generation was raised to think that men and women are the same, which is this idea that women can go out and have sex like a man, quote unquote, without getting attached, and that they are equal in that regard. And one of the quotes that I found that I put in my book, which I loved that I found because it's so new, is from this girl, Lena Dunham, I think, from the show Girls, who told a New York Times reporter that there is a biological reason why women feel the way they do and what about sex, and why men feel the way that they do, and it's not as simple as divesting yourself of your gender roles. So that was great, because that's exactly what I mean. They have been taught to believe that divesting yourself of these gender roles, purging yourself, if you will, of femininity and masculinity is what makes you equal. And it is so wrong, and it is setting them up for failure. So that's sort of where the impetus for this book that I've written.
Suzanne, I've got another call. Let's grab this from the 309 area code. What's your name, caller?
Well, I was just listening to the conversation, but I don't need to speak now because she said everything that I was thinking as far as the gender roles go and as far as marriages now, because I think if women and men went into the relationships depending on each other instead of going into the relationships thinking that, well, what do I need to do or how do I need to set myself up just in case this doesn't work, they weren't thinking that way in the first place. I think more marriages would last instead of going in there thinking that, well, 50% of them don't last and I got to set myself up just in case it doesn't. So,
do you take care of your woman financially?
Well, I don't have one now, so but every time I did, I always took care of it.
Well, we're talking about how to choose a husband. Susan, what about how to choose a wife?
Oh, well, that's so funny. My initial idea for this book was to have how to choose a husband on one side and then you flip it over. And then how to choose a wife.
That would be good.
My publishers didn't like that.
I don't know if my answer would be fair, because I'm kind of old-fashioned and I hear y'all talking about the modern-day relationships, but I think that I would like a woman, even if she wants to work and make her own money, I would like to be the breadwinner, and I want her to be able to depend on me that way. And know that she can feel safe, and that she will always be the protector of my family. So,
because do you believe a man innately wants to protect women? Well,
yeah.
Just you think that that's part of how it is, or that's just you?
Well, I know how this man feels,
mm-hmm.
And I feel innately that I want to be that strong person for her to be able to depend on, and that person she can lean on, and doesn't have to worry about being taken care of and being provided for. So,
and actually, if you're thinking that this conversation is different from your thoughts, it actually isn't, because my book is exactly what you're talking about, which is it is old-fashioned.
No, I know. That's what I was saying.
Yes.
You said what I needed to say. I didn't really need
yes.
to say it again. So.
She's saying what you're thinking is what
got
you're
it,
saying.
Got it.
Thank you, caller. Thank you so much. Just
what's
stay tuned. For more. I want to grab one more call here.
Okay.
Hi, caller, 312 area code. What's your name?
Oh, my name's Mick.
Hey, Mick, you got a question for Suzanne?
Sure. So far, we've been talking about how to choose a husband, and every caller, the caller so far has been men. So I'm going to say how to choose a wife. What I want to know.
Yeah.
I'm hearing the men who have called in, we're not successful in choosing a wife. So I want to know how to choose a wife.
Okay, that's a great question, and I really did want to come
and let Suzanne answer. Thanks for calling. Suzanne, I think there's another book in the works for sure.
I know. Well, here's the thing. I have sort of tapped into something inadvertently through writing these three books, and not just the three books, but the other writing that I do. And I hear from men all over the country and abroad, and they all say the same thing, basically, which is, where have all the feminine, traditional women gone? That is their biggest issue, is that the reason, and by the way, I should point out real quick that the most recent research from Pew Research is that women, when they were asked the question of how important marriage is to them in their lives, women's opinion on that in the last 15 years has gone up 7 points and men's has gone down 6. So there is a definite something happening here, which again goes back to the reason for my book, because what I'm trying to say is that we are basically pushing men away. That's my argument in the book, that women are doing that because they were given bad advice from the last generation. That's sort of the gist of it. And that because they have gotten so far away from the feminine creatures that they really are inside, they are inadvertently causing men to retreat from marriage. So a lot of these men, and I don't know about the specific callers, but I'm just telling you from what I'm hearing on my end, is it's just not worth it to marry anymore. I can't find this ABC kind of woman. So
what,
yeah.
You know what I'm really concerned about as you talk about this, and I think about this a lot with traditions in families. When I see, you know, we used to dye eggs and we hung ornaments on the tree, and I made sure that my children did all of those things. There are people who don't do that. So what's the trickle-down effect when you're not doing these things with kids and they don't do them with their kids and eventually it's just phased out? So how are these kids of these women that you're talking about going to behave when it comes time for their relationship or their marriage? What is this going to do to society eventually if we keep having this thought process?
Well, I think it's already happening. That's sort of my point, especially with the Pew study. It's already happening. You are going to copy essentially what you see growing up in terms of your general understanding. I mean, where do we all get our understanding of what marriage is and what our views on men and marriage are? They all come from, for women, our fathers, for, you know, for female view, your sons or what have you. But then our views of marriage, right, is coming from our parents' relationship. And so if that was a negative one, or if that environment you just described did not exist, where is your pattern or your role model going to be? You're going to, if you don't have it in your home, what do? You look outside your home, right? Well, guess what happens when you look out there? It's just as bad, right? So one of the things I started with chapter one in my book is it's entitled Live an Examined Life. And my point is that if you'd lived, let's say, in the 1940s and you were the product of divorce, that would have been really hard on you for sure. But when you looked outside your own home, guess what? Then guess what you would have seen then? Families, married people, mm-hmm. right? On TV, in your neighborhood, your cousins, you have other role models to look to. Today, that doesn't exist. Not only are they products of divorce, but they turn on the television and they look outside their homes, and there's no one to look to.
Susan, we're not going back to Leave It to Beaver. What we really need is looking forward how to be instead of going backwards and seeing how it used to be. You're not going to be able to put the toothpaste back in the tube. And as a matter of fact, the younger generation, let's take Gen Y, for example, which is anywhere up to about 30 years old, give or take, not definite. They have no problems with each other in who's supposed to take care of who. The men aren't threatened. They naturally expect women are going to be out of the house, really accomplish something. So I just don't see this solution as a going forward solution. Maybe you could address that.
What, and that's one of the biggest questions I get. And my response to that is always the same, which is just because you can't go back, and I completely agree with you, doesn't mean you can't look back and see what is it that we are missing, that where is it that we went wrong, that we can at least try to get right again, even though we can't copy exactly what we had, right? I think there's a way to do that in other areas of our lives, so I don't see why we can't do it with family. And plus, if we're going to go forward at all, we can't keep going forward in the direction that we're going in, so we need to pull from somewhere. So I think looking back is fine. I think looking back is fine. And so what do we know? What are the things that we know? We know marriage works. We know marriage is healthy and good for society. We know it's absolutely the best environment for kids. We know that people want it. That's another thing. Even though we have the divorce rate that we do, overwhelmingly when polled, people are still wanting, women especially, to get married. So that is still their ultimate goal. So if that's the case, then it makes sense to foster an environment and to help guide that generation to what we know works or doesn't work from our own errors, number one, and number two, just from common sense and human nature and research and all of that, why not do that? And so that's what I've tried to do with How to Choose a Husband, is saying, here's what we know, and there are some things that we know, and human nature is one of them, and the femininity and masculinity, that whole yin and yang, sort of an Eastern philosophy there, or Chinese or something, where this, you know, that there is a way that males and females bond or work together in tandem. And when it's allowed to be that, you know, truly masculine and truly feminine, it really can work. And what I'm saying is the reason why it hasn't is because women have taught essentially to become men and to just sort of chuck that feminine side to themselves and become more like men or adopt male traits. And they're trying to do it, and it's not working. It's turning men off. You know, what works for you in the workforce as a judge or as a host of a program, or even for me is whatever, is not necessarily what's going to work at home. In fact, I would argue quite the opposite, that the skills and the things that you use outside the home are not the same ones that you're going to use in your relationship at home, because it's not supposed to be a power struggle. It's supposed to be about control.
But according to your paradigm, she's not even going to get out of the home.
Why do you say that? Where did I ever say that? Where did I ever say that you
Oh, then I misunderstood. I thought you said get a flexible job if you have kids that keeps you in the home.
It's not about keeping you in a home. It's about
it's
the fact
like
that...
It's not like you're locked in there. You can go when you want.
You can do whatever you want. I don't care. I'm saying that women, the statistics show, the research shows, that overwhelmingly, when polled, when asked, women want flexible lives. They want part-time work if they're going to work at all when they have children. Now, if you have 40 or 50 years, women live longer lives than they've ever lived before. They have fewer children than ever, right? 2.5. So in all those years with your two children, you think you could maybe stay home for 5 or 10 years and take a break out of this other lifestyle that you're having? Why is that poo-pooed? I'm trying to say, if you want that, and chances are you will, start planning and thinking about it now. It's not a taboo thing. It's not something that's not possible. It is, and most people do want it. So no one said anything about staying home for 40 years of your life. And by the way, what's wrong with being at home? So
yeah,
it's that whole knee-jerk reaction to the home as a negative place that has gotten us to where we are right now.
Well, it's the whole Ann Romney discussion, you know, over again, and I think it almost shames people, mothers, into being mothers. You know, that they are mothers, and that there's some stigma attached to that. And I can't say enough that motherhood is the backbone of this. I mean, they're
but
so
Jill,
strong.
Right, and as do I. But to really get that, Jill, to really get that, you have to have done it yourself and really see the work and what's involved in it, because it's so easy to just, you know, have a few kids, never be there, and go about your business like what you were doing before and never really pick up on it. It's very easy, especially in today's culture, because that's what's fostered. But that's what, and you go back to what my work is in a larger theme of my three books, it's all about the demise of the American family in the last 40 years, since the 1960s, and the fallout of that. If you want to encompass, you know, all three of my books under one umbrella, that would really be it. It's all about the devaluing of parenting as a valuable, not just valuable, but like there's no way to exist in a healthy society without it. It's that instructive and that critical.
What's it? I missed that.
Without parents raising their
parenting.
Children.
Right.
Parenting.
What study is the one that said that parents want more flexible jobs? Moms do. And they don't want exactly careers or more flexible jobs. I hadn't heard of that, but that would be interesting.
Well, the reason why you haven't heard of that is because the media is comprised of the minority of women who choose the opposite life. So if you're referring to the dual income or working mother scenario where you literally work year-round, full-time, 40 years of your life, you take out, 6 weeks, 12 weeks for maternity leave and that's it, and you have substitute full-time care for your children and you go back to work and all of that, the women that you see all around you, Hollywood, media, news, all of that, they make up that portion of mothers. So, in fact, they're actually the minority, but you wouldn't know that because they're not going to tell you the truth about the facts about this issue because they don't want to be seen as the minority.
The liberal media.
Right. So Bernard Goldberg exposed this in 2004 with his book Bias, where he has a whole chapter that's titled The Most Important Story You Never Saw on TV. And what he was referring to is that what's happening to nation's children with absentee parenting is never reported. What's happening with daycare and the truth about daycare is never reported because the people who are giving you the news, they're dropping their babies off somewhere with someone else and they're leaving to do something else 12 to 15 hours a day. They're not in a position to be going to work and saying, here's what's happening with kids while I'm gone. Right?
I know that one of the things you said in your book is what it takes to get a man into bed is not the same as what it takes to get him to the altar. Would you want to talk a little about what that means?
Sure. Steve Harvey wrote a great book that you guys might have heard of called Act Like a Lady, Think Like a Man.
Right, right.
It became a movie. So I refer to him in the book a couple times. I quote him because since he's a man and it's coming from his mouth, I thought that would be good. He was basically talking about the difference between a sports keeper, I want to get that terminology right, and a fisher. I mean, and a fish, a sports keeper and a fish. And he's describing the process of a man walking up to a woman, meeting her for the first time and sort of summing her up, if you will. In that description, he says that a man can tell within the first 5 minutes whether or not you're going to be a sports fish or a keeper. And the sports fish is the girl who likes to have a good time and has absolutely no standards or requirements on anything. She just wants to have a good time. And that the keeper is really obvious because she immediately commands respect, not demands it, but commands it, and has very high standards for herself so that you ultimately have to chase her down in order to get her attention. Those are two completely different kinds of women, I shouldn't say women, but tactics, if you will, to sort of land a guy. Well, if your goal is to ultimately get a keeper, whether you're a man, if you're a woman and your goal is to not have a one-night stand, which for most women it's not, then your behavior needs to be according to whatever it is you're looking for. So those are two completely different paths to what's presumably the same goal. And so you just have to know which thing you're looking for, I guess, is the best way of putting it.
I think every woman should, or man, should be a sport fish and a keeper all rolled into one.
Well, yeah, an ideal world, right. But I think his point was just that they look out and they see two kinds of women. The ones you can bring home to mom and the ones you can't. And let's face it, come on, that's been going on since the beginning of time. It's always been that way. So there's nothing new about that. It's just that women have been taught, as I say, to have sex willy-nilly, just first date, second date, however many people, no big deal. It's just sex, 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 that they're not really thinking about what's my ultimate goal here. Is my goal love and marriage, or is my goal to get in the sack? And if the behavior and the dress that you're wearing, the dress code, the dress, not a dress, but how you're dressed, is screaming sex, then that's what you're going to get.
Well, I can just wear jeans and a turtleneck, and then sometimes my husband thinks that's screaming sex.
Well, that can be. That can be.
Well, that's husband, but we're
depends
not
on how you're wearing it.
I have a caller. I want to grab them. They've been on hold for a little bit. Let's pick them up. Hi, caller. How are you?
Oh, hello. Yes,
hello,
I'm here.
Hello, hello, hello. What's your name?
It's Doc. Everybody calls me Doc.
Okay, Doc, do you have a question for Suzanne?
No, I was actually just listening. I can't get any of my players in the browsers to work tonight, so I had to actually Skype in order to hear the show.
Oh, my. All right. Well, you just hang in there and listen. You might learn something really good about picking a wife.
Well, let's see what...
Well, I'm good on that department if you
oh,
look at my last post there in the chat room.
So is your wife dependent upon you financially?
Actually, I'm the one who's the stay-at-home dad. I was... originally the worker up to about 5-6 years ago now, and then my wife went into the work field because I'd got hurt my back, so I was a professional truck driver and just couldn't do that particular job anymore, and it was easier for her to go back into the market, and she enjoys working, but yeah, so we've always been basically a one income family. It was me for the first half of the marriage, and now it's her turn.
What about you not being able to protect her financially? Is that difficult on any level?
Nope, not at all. We live very well within our means. We're a family of five, married 15 years. We have our own home. We have all the entertainment things, if you will, you know, the Wii systems, the big screen televisions, you know, all that stuff. And we do it on $28,000 a year income. People have
so
to learn to live
that.
Within their means.
I'm
they become,
so glad you said that.
Send
yeah,
Jill your budget. She needs to know your budget.
I take care of the budget. I take care of that. Suzanne,
why do you say that you're so glad?
Oh,
you
I'm
said that.
So glad to hear him say that. I have been saying this for years. It's not about, it's all about the one income versus the two income, and the idea that if you're one income, you're somehow destitute, or that there's no way to live that way, and that is just not true. And that's why we started out the conversation talking about, yeah, in New York and California, you know, cost of living is insane, no question about it. But barring that, there is a way, and people have done it, to live on one income. And they can tell you how to do it. And more often than not, a lot of people who live the dual income lifestyle, even when they don't really want to, just because they were told they had to or they, you know, there was no other way to do it, it takes actually losing a job sometimes to do the math and figure out that you really weren't bringing in that much anyway, unless that second income was really, really high. So I love the stories of people who live on 28, 38, 48, whatever income and, you know, make it work, because that's so much about what my message is about that simple life and the one income, regardless of who's home.
Thanks, Doc, for your call. We really appreciate it. Stay tuned, okay?
You're welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Suzanne, what do you tell young women about sex, men, and marriage that's different from what society or even their parents are telling them?
I don't think any one of us would argue that this culture that we live in today is just saturated in sex. I don't even think that could possibly be debated. Of course it is. So that environment in and of itself is so vastly different from the way things were decades ago that it's a constant thing that you have to deal with that shouldn't be, because sex is not the be-all, end-all. It's not your whole life. It's not that significant. It's definitely important. It's great, and it's necessary, but it's not everything. And the way that it is treated in the culture now, you would think that it is. So that's one thing. The second thing is this idea that sex is dismissed as something that, for women in particular, but just for people, is something that connects you emotionally, that it's just a fun thing. You know, that it's just something to get your rocks off, or just something to, you know, do for the time being, or you're going to move from one guy to the next, or what have you. Where did opening your legs on the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, whatever date come from?
What date should bad legs get open?
That's, well...
the marriage, or...
Not, yeah. Let me put it to you this way. Sex is for committed, loving, monogamous, adult human beings. Is that fair?
Yeah.
That takes a long time to get to that point. And this whole business of shack, you know, whatever, it's just hanging out with your friends, having sex with your friends, just having sex for the sake of having sex is so horrid. It's just it really ruined an entire generation of women, in my opinion. So I do think there's room for discussion between the all sex all the time versus chastity until you're married, particularly because today, of course, people aren't marrying until their late 20s, so that does pose a little bit of a problem. But so I'm reasonable, but my point is that it's not recreation. It's part of something that it takes time to develop that relationship to get to that point, and you are undermining it by doing it right away. That's my argument.
It's not recreation. You may not be doing it right.
You know what I mean. mean. It could be recreation when you're married or when you're
I'm kidding, of course.
Well, we've got just a few minutes left, and I want to just go over your contact information and your website, Suzanne, so that people who are interested in purchasing your book when it comes out in February 2013, and it actually is coming out on Valentine's Day, right?
I think so, although Amazon now says February 5th, so I'm not sure how that happened.
Okay, well, it would be a
I hope we get a good release date. You know how that kind of matters. So.
And the book is red.
And the book is red.
And the book is red. So
well, our books came out in January, right, Michelle? Wasn't it January 2010 they came out? And mine had a big heart on it, so it was close to Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Yours was about divorce.
January. And it was blue, so that was perfect.
Blue. Yeah, perfect. Well, anyway, this book, How to Choose a Husband and Make Peace with Marriage, is going to be something that everyone should read. I've read it, and I think it's really something interesting. And if you're thinking about marriage, if you're contemplating man or woman, because really, Suzanne, the book is for men and women, right?
Thank you for saying that. It absolutely is, and I'm sorry that the title doesn't exactly say that. I didn't like that part of it, but it is for both, for sure.
In the book, talking about extolling femininity and the joy of being a considerate wife to a good man.
We do talk about that, yes. In fact, the last chapter is all how to be a wife and are learning how to be a wife and what do you bring to the table and thinking about it that way instead of just, you know, not thinking about it at all. You know, what do I bring to the table? So I list six specific things there about being a wife. Things
Michelle,
I've learned the hard way, by the way.
For Suzanne, Michelle?
I think I better read the book.
Well, I think you should.
Obviously, I could use a little advice.
Yes, we might want to work privately with her, Suzanne.
Well, it's also important, though, this is everything I've said in there, I have learned the hard way, and I am very honest in this book. I think you can vouch for that, Jill, in saying that I definitely have not always been, and still am not maybe, the wife I would like to be, but I have learned what not to do. Let's put it that way.
Well, I'll tell you something, Susan. I think you're going to have your next book, which is going to be your experiences on book tour, because you're going to have a lot of interesting reactions. And write them all down because, you know, it's going to be really juicy.
It is. I couldn't agree with you more. It's a fun topic, and people have certainly a lot to say about it, so it should be interesting.
And a lot of difference of opinions.
Yeah, definitely.
And on that note...
On that note, I always say I am the best wife ever. I just had the wrong husband first time around. You know, so maybe that's the title of your next book. But I just think that marriage is an ever-changing thing, and you always have to work at it. And these young people today that are looking at marriage have to understand that it's not just something you do it because you want to be married. You got to get in there and you got to work every single day to make a successful, happy marriage with two people depending on each other. That's just my personal belief, and I hope everybody out there can take a look at Suzanne's book and really be open-minded about it when you're reading it, because there's a lot of interesting things in this book that you could employ in your new relationship, in your current relationship, and I'm excited that Suzanne was with us tonight to talk about it. So
thank you very much, Suzanne, and have a great ride.
Thank you
so much, and
so much for your time.
Come back after the book.
That'd
comes
be great.
Out. We'll do
Let's
this
do
again.
It. Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Thank you. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.